This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio proudly presents Modern Romance by Aziz Ansari with Eric Kleinenberg. This is the author, Aziz Ansari.
Hi! That was me as well. This is Aziz. This is the audiobook of my book, Modern Romance. And I'm going to read it to you. God, you're so lazy. You don't have time to read it yourself? You want me to read it to you? All right. This should be fun. I wonder what you're doing right now. Are you like curled up in bed with some tea by a fire? And you throwing this MP3 on? Ooh, that sounds nice. All right. Are you getting irritated that I haven't started the book yet? What if I spent another 5 minutes talking about how lazy you are for not actually reading the physical book? No, I'm not. Here we go. This track's playing the whole time, by the way. I hope that's not a problem. What's that? We can't do that? Aw, come on. Really? Alright. Let's just fade it out nice. Hold on, let's I love this part. Ooh, there it goes. That's it. Yeah. You didn't think I was gonna let it go this long, did you? I know, we should probably start reading the book soon. Honestly, it's just a kind of a dope fucking song, man. I'm really getting in the groove here. This is like, if this was playing in a grocery store, everyone would just start fucking in the aisles. Here we go. We're beginning. Introduction. Oh shit, thanks for buying my book. That money is mine. But I worked really hard on this, and I think you'll enjoy it. First off, a little about this project. When you have success as a stand-up comedian, you quickly get offers to do a humor book. In the past, I always turned down these opportunities because I thought stand-up was the best medium for me. In my mind, a book wouldn't be as fun as just using my ideas for stand-up. So why did I decide to write a book about modern romance? A few years ago, there was a woman in my life. Let's call her Tanya. And we had hooked up one night in L.A. We both attended a birthday party, and when things were winding down, she offered to drop me off at home. We'd been chatting and flirting a little the whole night, so I asked her to come in for a drink. At the time, I was subletting a pretty nice house up in the Hollywood Hills. It was kind of like that house De Niro had in Heat, but a little more my vibe than the vibe of a really skilled robber who takes down armored cars. I made us both a nice cocktail, and we took turns, throwing on records while we chatted and laughed. Eventually, we started making out, and it was pretty awesome. I remember drunkenly saying something really dumb when she was leaving, like, "Tanya, you're a very charming lady." She said, "Aziz, you're a pretty charming guy, too." The encounter seemed promising, as everyone in the room had agreed, we were both charming people. I wanted to see Tanya again and was faced with a simple conundrum that plagues us all. How and when do I communicate next? Do I call? Do I text? Do I send a Facebook message? Do I send up a smoke signal? How does one do that? Will I set my rented house on fire? How embarrassed will I be when I have to tell the home's owner, actor James Earl Jones, that I burned his house down trying to send a smoke signal? Oh no. I just revealed whose sick house I'd rented. King Joffy Joffer himself, the voice of Darth Vader, film legend, James Earl Jones. Eventually I decided to text her because she seemed to be a heavy texter. I waited a few days so as not to seem overeager. I found out that the band Beach House, which we listened to the night we made out, was playing that week in L.A., so it seemed like the perfect move. Here was my text. "Hey, don't know if you left for NYC, but Beach House playing tonight and tomorrow at Wiltern. You want to go? ? Maybe they'll let you cover the motto if we ask nicely? ? Alright, this is a little audiobook aside. I know it's weird I said ? But, you know, when you're sending texts and stuff, the punctuation and stuff can be very, very important. So, that's why I said ? Anyway, back to the book. A nice firm ask with a little inside joke thrown in. Tanya was singing the Drake song, The Motto, at the party and impressively knew almost all the lyrics. I was pretty confident. I wasn't head over heels in love with Tanya, but she seemed really cool and it felt like we had a good connection. As I waited for a response, I started picturing our hypothetical relationship. Perhaps next weekend we would go see a movie at the cool outdoor screening series they do at the Hollywood Forever Cemetery. Maybe I could cook Tanya dinner later this week and try out that brick chicken recipe I'd been eager to attempt. Would Tanya and I go vacation in Ojai later in the fall? Who knew what our future would be? This was going to be great. A few minutes went by, and the status of my text message changed to red. My heart stopped. This was a moment of truth. I braced myself and watched as those little iPhone dots popped up, the ones that tantalizingly tell you someone is typing a response, the smartphone equivalent of the slow trip up to the top of a roller coaster. But then, in a few seconds, they vanished, and there was no response from Tanya. What happened? A few more minutes go by, and nothing. No problem. She's probably just crafting her perfectly witty response. She started a draft, didn't feel good about it, and wanted to get back to it later. I get it. She also probably didn't want to seem overeager and be writing back so fast, right? 15 minutes go by. Nothing. My confidence starts going down and shifting into doubt. An hour goes by. Nothing. 2 hours go by. Nothing. 3 hours go by. Nothing. A mild panic begins. I start staring at my original text. Once so confident, now I second guess it all.
Hey, don't know if you left for NYC, but Beach House playing tonight and tomorrow at the Wiltern. You want to go? Maybe they'll let you cover the motto if we ask nicely.
I'm so stupid. Should have typed hey with two Y's, not just one. I asked too many questions. What the fuck was I thinking? Oh, there I go again with another question. Aziz, what's up with you and the questions? I'm struggling to figure it out, but trying to keep calm. Okay, maybe she's busy with work. No big deal. I'm sure she'll get back to me as soon as she can. We had a connection, right? A fucking day goes by. A full day. Now my thoughts get crazier. What has happened? I know she held my words in her hand. Did Tanya's phone fall into a river slash trash compactor slash volcano? Did Tanya fall into a river slash trash compactor slash volcano? Oh no, Tanya has died and I'm selfishly worried about our date. I'm a bad person. I shared my dilemma with a friend. Aw, come on, man. It's fine. She'll get back to you. She's probably just busy, he said optimistically. Then I look on social media. I see her logged on to Facebook chat. Do I send a message? No! Don't do that, Aziz. Be cool. Be cool. Later, I check Instagram, and this clown Tanya is posting a photo of some horse. Too busy to write me back, but she has time to do a photo shoot with some horse she saw on a hike? I'm distraught, but then I have a moment of clarity that every idiot has in this situation. Maybe she didn't get the text. Yes, that's what happened, right? There was a glitch in her phone of some sort. Of course. This is when I contemplate a second text, but I'm hesitant due to the fact that this scenario has never happened with my friends. Hey, Alan, I texted you to go get dinner and you didn't write me back for a full day. What happened? Damn, I didn't see the text. It didn't go through. Glitch in my phone. Sorry about that. Let's grab dinner tomorrow. Back to the Tanya situation. At this point, it's been more than 24 hours. It's Wednesday. The concert is tonight. To not even write back and say no, why would she do that? At least say no so I can take someone else, right? Why, Tanya, why? I start going nuts thinking about it. How can this person be so rude on so many levels? I'm not just some bozo. She's known me for years. I kept debating whether I should send anything, but I felt it would just be too desperate and accepted that she wasn't interested. I told myself that I wouldn't want to go out with someone who treats people that way anyway, which was somewhat true, but I was still beyond frustrated and insulted. Then I realized something interesting. The madness I was descending into wouldn't have even existed 20 or even 10 years ago. There I was, maniacally checking my phone every few minutes, going through this tornado of panic and hurt and anger, all because this person hadn't written me a short, stupid message on a dumb little phone. I was really upset. But had Tanya really done anything that rude or malicious? No, she just didn't send a message in order to avoid an awkward situation. I'd surely done the same thing to someone else and not realize a similar grief I'd possibly caused them. I didn't end up going to the concert that night. Instead, I went to a comedy club and started talking about the awful frustration, self-doubt, and rage that this whole silence nonsense had provoked in the depths of my being. I got laughs, but also something bigger, like the audience and I were connecting on a deeper level. I could tell that every guy and girl in the audience had had their own Tanya in their phone at one point or another, each with their own individual problems and dilemmas. We each sit alone, staring at this black screen with a whole range of emotions. But in a strange way, we were all doing it together. And we should take solace in the fact that no one has a clue what's going on. I got fascinated by the questions of how and why so many people have become so perplexed by the challenge of doing something that people have always done quite efficiently, finding romance. I started asking people I knew if there was a book that would help me understand the many challenges of looking for love in the digital age. I found some interesting pieces here and there, but not the kind of comprehensive, in-depth sociological investigation I was looking for. That book simply didn't exist, so I decided to try to write it myself. When I started the project, I thought the big changes in romance were obvious. Technological developments like smartphones, online dating, and social media sites. As I dug deeper, however, I realized that the transformation of our romantic lives cannot be explained by technology alone. There's much more to the story. In a very short period of time, the whole culture of finding love in a mate has radically changed. A century ago, people would find a decent person who lived in their neighborhood. Their families would meet, and after they decided neither party seemed like a murderer, the couple would get married and have a kid, all by the time they were 22. Today, people spend years of their lives on a quest to find the perfect person, a soulmate. The tools we use on this search are different, but what has really changed are our desires, and even more strikingly, the underlying goals of the search itself. The more I thought about these changes, the more I had to write this book. But I also knew that I, bozo comedian Aziz Ansari, probably couldn't tackle this topic on my own. So I decided to reach out to some very smart people to guide me. I teamed up with the sociologist Eric Kleinenberg, and we designed a massive research project, one that would require more than a year of investigation in cities across the world and involve some of the leading experts on love and romance. Before we get into things, I want to tell you more about our project so you know what we did and didn't do. The primary source of data for this book is a research that Eric and I did during 2013 and 2014. We conducted focus groups and interviews with hundreds of people in New York City, Los Angeles, Wichita, Monroe, New York, Buenos Aires, Tokyo, Paris, and Doha. These weren't ordinary interviews. First, we assembled diverse groups of people and wound up having incredibly personal conversations about the intimate details of their romantic lives. Second, and even more intriguing, many of the people who participated in our research volunteered to share their phones with us so we could track their interactions through text messages, emails, online dating sites, and swipe apps like Tinder. This information was revelatory because we could observe how actual romantic encounters played out in people's lives and not just hear stories about what people remembered. Since we asked people to share so much personal information, we promised them anonymity. That means all the names of people whose stories we tell here are pseudonyms, as is standard practice in qualitative social science research. To expand our reach beyond just those cities, we created a modern romantic subreddit forum on the website Reddit to ask questions and essentially conduct a massive online focus group receiving thousands of responses from around the world. I want to give huge thanks to everyone who participated in these sessions, as the book would not have been possible without them. So in the book, when we mention the subreddit, this is what we are referring to. We also spent a long time interviewing some incredibly smart people, including eminent sociologists, anthropologists, psychologists, and journalists who have dedicated their careers to studying modern romance, and who were very generous with their time. Here's a list that I'm terrified I'm going to leave someone off of. Dana Boyd of Microsoft, Andrew Cherlin of Johns Hopkins University, Stephanie Kuntz of Evergreen State College, Pamela Druckerman of the New York Times, Kumiko Endo of the New School, who also assisted us with our research in Tokyo, Eli Finkel of Northwestern University, Helen Fisher of Rutgers University, Jonathan Haidt of NYU, Sheena Iyengar of Columbia University, Dan Savage, Natasha Schull of MIT, Barry Schwartz of Swarthmore College, Clay Shirky of NYU, Sherry Turkle of MIT, and Rob Willer of Stanford, who also helped us design some research questions and analyze our data. In addition to these interviews, we got access to some amazing quantitative data that we use extensively here. For the past 5 years, Match.com has sponsored the largest survey of American singles around, a nationally representative sample of about 5,000 people with questions about all kinds of fascinating behaviors and preferences. Match generously shared it with us, and we in turn will share our analysis of it with you. We've also benefited from the goodwill of Christian Rutter and OkCupid, which has collected a treasure trove of data on how its users behave. This information has been incredibly useful, because it allows us to distinguish between what people say they want and what people actually do. Another great source of data was from Michael Rosenfeld at Stanford University, who shared material from the How Couples Meet and Stay Together survey, a nationally representative survey of 4,002 English literate adults, three-quarters of whom had a spouse or romantic partner. Rosenfeld, as well as another researcher, Jonathan Haidt of NYU, gave us permission to use charts that they had developed in this book. Big thanks to them both. And you won't see none of these charts because you got the audiobook, so I'll try to describe them or something, but I don't know. You may have screwed up. I mean, you get to hear my lovely voice, but no charts. Anyway, back to the book. With the help of all these people, Eric and I managed to cover a vast set of issues related to modern romance, but we didn't cover everything. One thing that I definitely want you to know up front is that this book is primarily about heterosexual relationships. Early in the process, Eric and I realized that if we tried to write about how all the different aspects of romance we address apply to LGBT relationships, We simply wouldn't be able to do the topic justice without writing an entirely separate book. We do cover some issues relating to love and romance among gays and lesbians, but not at all exhaustively. The other thing I want to say here is that most of the research we did involved speaking with middle-class people, folks who had gone to college and put off having kids until their late 20s or 30s and now have quite intense and intimate relationships with their expensive smartphones. I know that love and romance work differently in very poor and very rich communities, both in the United States and in the other countries we visited for our research. But again, Eric and I felt that studying all the variations related to class would overwhelm us, so that's not in the book. Okay, that's pretty much what you need to know by way of introduction. But before we begin, I do want to give a sincere thanks to you, the listener. You could have bought any book in the world if you wanted. You could have picked up a copy of Unruly, The Highs and Lows of Becoming a Man by Ja Rule. You could have bought Rich Dad, Poor Dad. You could have even bought Rich Ja, Poor Ja, Ja Rule's Guide to Sensible Finance. You could have bought all those books, and maybe you did, except for the last one, which, despite my repeated emails, Ja Rule continues to refuse to write. But you also bought mine, and for that, I thank you. Now, let's begin our journey into the world of modern romance. Chapter 1, Searching for Your Soulmate. Many of the frustrations experienced by today's singles seem like problems unique to our time and technological setting. Not hearing back on a text, agonizing over what really is your favorite movie for your online dating profile. Wondering whether you should teleport over some roses to that girl you had dinner with last night. Hey, so if the teleportation thing isn't figured out by June 2015, we'll lose that line, right? Okay, I just want to make sure. Well, the science advisor dudes were like, yeah, teleportation will be out, like, April, so it'll probably be a big thing by June, so that's why I'm saying it. All right. Thanks, guys. These kind of quirks are definitely new to the romantic world, but as I investigated and interviewed for this book, I found that the changes in romance and love are much deeper and bigger in scale than I realized. Right now, I'm one of millions of young people who are in a similar place. We are meeting people, dating, getting into and out of relationships, all with the hope of finding someone we truly love and with whom we share a deep connection. We may even want to get married and start a family too. This journey seems fairly standard now, but it's wildly different from what people did even just decades ago. To be specific, I now see that our ideas about two things, searching and the right person, are completely different from what they used to be, which means our expectations about how courtship works are too. Donuts for Interviews, a visit to a New York retirement community. If I wanted to see how things have changed over time, I figured that I should start by learning about the experience of the older generations still around today. And that meant talking to some old folks. To be honest, I tend to romanticize the past, and though I appreciate all the conveniences of modern life, sometimes I yearn for simpler times. Wouldn't it be cool to be single in a bygone era? I take a girl to a drive-in movie, we go have a cheeseburger and a malt at the diner, and then we make out under the stars in my old-timey convertible. Granted, this might have been tough in the 50s given my brown skin tone and racial tensions at the time, but in my fantasy, racial harmony is also part of the deal. So, to learn about romance in this era, Eric and I went down to a retirement community on the Lower East Side of New York City to interview some seniors. We came armed with a big box of Dunkin' Donuts and some coffee, tools that the staff had said would be key to convincing the old folks to speak with us. Sure enough, when the seniors caught a whiff of donuts, they were quick to pull up chairs and start answering our questions. One 88-year-old man named Alfredo took to the donuts very quickly. About 10 minutes into the discussion, to which he'd contributed nothing but his age and name, he looked at me with a confused expression, threw up his donut-covered hands, and left. When we came back a few days later to do more interviews, Alfredo was back. The staff explained that Alfredo had misunderstood the purpose of the previous meeting. He thought we wanted to talk to him about his time in the war, but he was now fully prepared to answer questions about his own experiences in love and marriage. Once again, he was pretty quick to take down a donut, and then, faster than you could wipe the last few crumbs of a French cruller off your upper lip, Alfredo was gonzo. I can only hope that a similarly easy way to scheme free donuts presents itself to me when I go into retirement. Thankfully, others were more informative. Victoria, age 68, grew up in New York City. She got married when she was 21, to a man who lived in the same apartment complex, one floor above her. I was standing in front of my building with some friends, and he approached me, Victoria said. He told me he liked me very much and asked if I'd like to go out with him. I didn't say anything. He asked me 2 or 3 more times before I agreed to go out with him. It was Victoria's first date. They went to a movie and had dinner at her mom's house afterward. He soon became her boyfriend, and after a year of dating, her husband. They've been married for 48 years. When Victoria first told me her story, it had aspects I expected to be common among the group. She married very young, her parents met her boyfriend almost immediately, and they shifted into marriage fairly quickly. I figured that the part about marrying someone who lived in her same building was kind of random. But then, the next woman we spoke with, Sandra, 78, said she got married to a guy who lived just across the street. Stevie, 69, married a woman who lived down the hall. Jose, 75, married a woman who lived one street over. Alfredo married someone from across the street, probably the daughter of the neighborhood donut shop owner. It was remarkable. In total, 14 of the 36 seniors I spoke with had ended up marrying someone who lived within walking distance of their childhood home. People were marrying neighbors who lived on the same street, in the same neighborhood, and even in the same building. It seemed a bit bizarre. "Guys," I said, "you're in New York City. Did you ever think, oh, maybe there's some people outside of my building? Why limit yourself so much? Why not expand your horizons?" They just shrugged and said it wasn't what was done. After our interviews, we examined whether this spoke to a larger trend. In 1932, a sociologist at the University of Pennsylvania named James Bossard looked through 5,000 consecutive marriage licenses on file for people who lived in the city of Philadelphia. Whoa. One-third of the couples who got married had lived within a 5-block radius of each other before they got married. 1 out of 6 had lived within the same block. Most amazingly, 1 of every 8 married couples had lived in the same building before they got married. Maybe this trend of marrying locally held in big cities but not elsewhere. Well, a lot of sociologists in the 30s and 40s were wondering the same thing, and they reported their findings in the leading social science journals of the time. Yep. Their findings were remarkably similar to Bossard's in Philadelphia, with a few variations. For instance, people in smaller towns also married neighbors when they were available. But when they weren't, because the pool was too small, people expanded their horizons, but only as far as was necessary. As the Yale sociologist John Ellsworth Jr. said after a study of marriage patterns in Simsbury, Connecticut, population 3,941, "people will go as far as they have to find a mate, but no farther." Things are obviously very different today. I found out sociologists don't even do these sort of studies on the geography of marriage at the city level anymore. Personally, I can't think of even one friend who married someone from their neighborhood, and hardly anyone who married a person from their home city. For the most part, my friends married people they'd met during their post-college years when they were exposed to folks from all over the country, and in some cases all over the world. Think about where you grew up as a kid, your apartment building or your neighborhood. Could you imagine being married to one of those clowns? Emerging adulthood, when grown-ups grow up. One reason it's so hard to imagine marrying the people we grew up with is that these days we marry much later than people in previous generations. For the generation of people I interviewed in the New York City retirement community, the average age of marriage was around 20 for women and 23 for men. Today, the average age of first marriage is about 27 for women and 29 for men. And it's around 30 for both men and women in big cities like New York and Philadelphia. Why has this age of first marriage increased so dramatically in the past few decades? For the young people who got married in the 1950s, getting married was the first step in adulthood. After high school or college, you got married and you left the house. For today's folks, marriage is usually one of the later stages in adulthood. Now, most young people spend their 20s and 30s in another stage of life, where they go to university, start a career, and experience being an adult outside of their parents' home before marriage. This period isn't all about finding a mate and getting married. You have other priorities as well. Getting educated, trying out different jobs, having a few relationships, and with luck, becoming a more fully developed person. Sociologists even have a name for this new stage of life: emerging adulthood. With this stage, we also wind up greatly expanding our pool of romantic options. Instead of staying in the neighborhood or our building, we move to new cities, spend years meeting people in college and workplaces, and, in the biggest game changer, have the infinite possibilities provided by online dating and other similar technologies. Besides the effects it has on marriage, emerging adulthood also offers young people an exciting, fun period of independence from their parents, when they get to enjoy the pleasures of adulthood before becoming husbands and wives and starting a family. If you're like me, you couldn't imagine getting married without going through all this. When I was 23, I knew nothing about what I was going to be as an adult. I was a business and biology major at NYU. Would I have married some girl who lived a few blocks from me in Bennettsville, South Carolina, where I grew up? What was this mysterious biology business I planned on setting up anyway? I have no clue. I was an idiot who definitely wasn't ready for such huge life decisions. My Bubba Sparks tattoo is a constant reminder. The seniors we spoke with simply did not have such a life stage, and many seemed to regret the lack of it. This was especially true for the women, who didn't have much chance to pursue higher education and start careers of their own. Before the 1960s, in most parts of the United States, single women simply didn't live alone, and many families frowned upon their daughters moving into shared housing for working girls. Until they got married, these women were pretty much stuck at home under fairly strict adult supervision and lacked basic adult autonomy. They always had to let their parents know their whereabouts and plans. Even dating had heavy parental involvement. The parents would either have to approve the boy or accompany them on the date. At one point during a focus group with older women, I asked them straight out whether a lot of the women their age got married just to get out of the house. Every single woman there nodded. For women in this era, it seemed that marriage was the easiest way of acquiring the basic freedoms of adulthood. Things weren't a breeze after that, though. Marriage, most women quickly discovered, liberated them from their parents, but made them dependent on a man who might or might not treat them well, and then saddled them with the responsibilities of homemaking and child-rearing. It gave women of this era what was described at the time by Betty Friedan in her best-selling book, The Feminine Mystique, as the problem that has no name. In her first draft, Friedan named the problem Hampton, but her editors told her it wasn't catchy enough. Once women gained access to the labor market and won the right to divorce, the divorce rate skyrocketed. Some of the older women I met in our focus groups had left their husbands during the height of the divorce revolution, and they told me that they'd always resented missing out on something singular and special. The experience of being a young, unencumbered single woman. They wanted emerging adulthood. I think I missed a stage in my life, the stage where you go out with friends, Amelia said wistfully. I was never allowed to go out with my friends. My father wouldn't allow it. He was that strict. So I tell my granddaughters, enjoy yourself. Enjoy yourself. Then get married. Hopefully this doesn't lead to Amelia's granddaughters doing a ton of ecstasy and then telling their mom, Grandma told me to enjoy myself! Leave me alone! This sentiment was widely shared. Everyone, including the women who said they were happily married, said they wanted their daughters and granddaughters to approach marriage differently from how they had. They wanted the young women they knew to date a lot of men and experience different relationships before they took a husband. My daughter, I told her, go out. Get an education, get a car, enjoy yourself, said Amelia. Then at the end, choose someone. Even Victoria, who had been married for 48 years to the man who grew up in the apartment above her, agreed. She emphasized that she loved her husband dearly, but hinted that, given another chance, she might have done something else. My husband and I, we understand each other, she said, but we're very different. Sometimes I wonder if I had married someone who had the same interests as me. She trailed off. Maybe she was interested in donuts and was thinking about a life with Alfredo? The Luxury of Happiness, From Companionate to Soulmate Marriage. The shift in when we look for love in marriage has been accompanied by a change in what we look for in a marriage partner. When the older folks I interviewed described the reasons that they dated, got engaged to, and then married their eventual spouses, they'd say things like, he seemed like a pretty good guy. She was a nice girl. He had a good job, and she had access to donuts, and I like donuts. Yep, Alfredo. When you ask people today why they married someone, the answers are much more dramatic and loving. You hear things along the lines of, she is my other half. I can't imagine experiencing the joys of life without him by my side. Or, every time I touch your hair, I get a huge boner. On our subreddit, we ask people, If you've been married or in a long-term relationship, how did you decide that the person was or still is the right person for you? What made this person different from others? The responses were strikingly unlike the ones we got from the older people we met at the senior center. Many were filled with stories that illustrated a very deep connection between the two people that made them feel like they'd found someone unique, not just someone who was pleasant to start a family with. One woman wrote, "The first moment I truly remember falling in love with my boyfriend was when I was singing Whitney Houston's Greatest Love of All under my breath to myself while we were studying near each other. And then he started singing it at the top of his lungs. And we sang the whole song, just laughing and dancing around the room. Moments like those where I feel so free and goofy and love make me know he's the right person. Also, I feel like since we've been together, I have become the best version of myself. I push myself to try different things and keep learning, even though I'm out of school. It's so much for myself, but having his support in my corner has made all the difference." Another woman wrote, "He makes me laugh, and if I don't feel like laughing, he stops and takes the time to find out why. He makes me feel beautiful and loved in my most ugly and unlovable moments. We also share the same faith, morals, work ethic, love of movies and music, and the desire to travel." And one said, "He's different from everyone because he's a one-of-a-kind human being. There's no one in this world like him. He's stunning, and I'm amazed by him every single day. He's made me a better person for having known and loved him. 5 years going strong, and I'm still obsessed with him. He is my best friend." All of these people had found someone truly special. From the way they described things, it seemed like their bar for committing to someone was much higher than it had been for the older folks who settled down just a few generations ago. To figure out why people today use such exalted terms when they explain why they committed to their romantic partner, I spoke with Andrew Cherlin, the eminent sociologist of the family and author of the book The Marriage Go-Round. Up until about 50 years ago, Cherlin said, most people were satisfied with what he calls a companionate marriage. In this type of marriage, each partner had clearly defined roles. A man was the head of his household and the chief breadwinner, while a woman stayed home, took care of the house, and had kids. Most of the satisfaction you gained in the marriage depended on how well you fulfilled this assigned role. As a man, if you brought home the bacon, you could feel like you were a good husband. As a woman, if you kept a clean house and popped out 2.5 kids, you were a good wife. You loved your spouse, maybe, but not in an every time I see his mustache, my heart flutters like a butterfly type of way. You didn't marry each other because you were madly in love. You married because you could make a family together. While some people said they were getting married for love, the pressure to get married and start a family was such that not every match could be a love match. So instead, we had the good enough marriage. Waiting for true love was a luxury that many, especially women, could not afford. In the early 1960s, a full 76% of women admitted they would be willing to marry someone they didn't love. However, only 35% of the men said they would do the same. If you were a woman, you had far less time to find a man. True love? This guy has a job and a decent mustache. Lock it down, girl. This gets into a fundamental change in how marriage is viewed. Today we see getting married as finding a life partner, someone we love, but this whole idea of marrying for happiness and love is relatively new. For most of the history of our species, courtship and marriage weren't really about two individuals finding love and fulfillment. According to the historian Stephanie Kuntz, author of Marriage, A History, until recently a marital union was primarily important for establishing a bond between two families. It was about achieving security, financial, social, and personal. It was about creating conditions that made it possible to survive and reproduce. This is not ancient history. Until the Industrial Revolution, most Americans and Europeans lived on farms, and everybody in the household needed to work. Considerations about whom to marry were primarily practical. In the past, a guy would be thinking, "Oh shit, I gotta have kids to work on my farm. I need 4-year-old kids performing manual labor ASAP, and I need a woman who can make me clothes. I better get on this." A woman would think, "I better find a dude who's capable on the farm and good with the plow so I don't starve and die." Making sure the person shared your interest in sushi and Wes Anderson movies and made you get a boner anytime you touched her hair would seem far too picky. Of course, people did get married because they loved each other, but their expectations about what love would bring were different from those we hold today. For families whose future security depended on their children making good matches, passion was seen as an extremely risky motivation for getting hitched. Marriage was too vital an economic and political institution to be entered into solely on the basis of something as irrational as love, writes Kuntz. Kuntz also told us that before the 1960s, most middle-class people had pretty rigid gender-based expectations about what each person would bring to a marriage. Women wanted financial security. Men wanted virginity and weren't concerned with deeper qualities like education or intelligence. The average couple wed after just 6 months, a pretty good sign that love was still filtered through strong gender stereotypes, rather than being based on deep knowledge of the other partner as an individual, she said. Not that people who got married before the 1960s had loveless marriages. On the contrary, back then, couples often developed increasingly intense feelings for each other as they spent time together, growing up and building their families. These marriages may have started with a simmer, but over time, they could build to a boil. But a lot of things changed in the 1960s and 1970s, including our expectations of what we should get out of a marriage. The push for women's equality was a big driver of the transformation. As more women went to college, got good jobs, and achieved economic independence, they established newfound control over their bodies and their lives. A growing number of women refused to marry the guy in their neighborhood or building. They wanted to experience things too, and they now had the freedom to do it. According to Cherlin, the generation that came of age during the 60s and 70s rejected companionate marriage and began to pursue something greater. They didn't merely want a spouse, they wanted a soulmate. By the 1980s, 86% of American men and 91% of American women said they would not marry someone without the presence of romantic love. The soulmate marriage is very different from the companionate marriage. It's not about finding someone decent to start a family with. It's about finding the perfect person whom you truly, deeply love. Someone you want to share the rest of your life with. Someone with whom, when you smell a certain t-shirt they own, you were instantly whisked to a happy memory about the time he or she made you breakfast and you both stayed in and binge-watched all 8 seasons of Perfect Strangers. We want something that's very passionate or boiling from the get-go. In the past, people weren't looking for something boiling. They just needed some water. Once they found it and committed to a life together, they did their best to heat things up. Now, if things aren't boiling, committing to marriage seems premature. But searching for a soulmate takes a long time and requires enormous emotional investment. The problem is that this search for the perfect person can generate a lot of stress. Younger generations face immense pressure to find the perfect person that simply didn't exist in the past when good enough was good enough. When they're successful, though, the payoff is incredible. According to Cherlin, the soulmate marriage has the highest potential for happiness, and it delivers levels of fulfillment that the generation of older people I interviewed rarely reached. Cherlin is also well aware of how hard it is to sustain all these good things, and he claims that today's soulmate marriage model has the highest potential for disappointment. Since our expectations are so high, today, people are quick to break things off when their relationship doesn't meet them. Touch the hair, no boner. Cherlin would also like me to reiterate that this hair-boner analogy is mine and mine alone. The psychotherapist Esther Perel has counseled hundreds of couples who are having trouble in their marriages. And as she sees things, asking all this from a marriage puts a lot of pressure on relationships. In her words, marriage was an economic institution in which you were given a partnership for life in terms of children and social status and succession and companionship. But now we want our partner to still give us all these things, but in addition, I want you to be my best friend and my trusted confidant and my passionate lover to boot. And we live twice as long. So we come to one person and we basically are asking them to give us what once an entire village used to provide. Give me belonging. Give me identity. Give me continuity. But give me transcendence and mystery and awe all in one. Give me comfort. Give me edge. Give me novelty. Give me familiarity. Give me predictability. Give me surprise. And we think it's a given. And toys and lingerie are going to save us with that. Ideally, though, we're lucky and we find our soulmate and enjoy that life-changing motherload of happiness. But a soulmate is a very hard thing to find. Finding your soulmate. Okay, so no one said searching for a soulmate would be easy. Still, in many ways, it seems like today's generation of singles is better off because of the changes in modern romance. Taking time to develop ourselves and date different people before we get married helps us make better choices. For instance, people who marry after the age of 25 are far less likely to divorce than those who get married young. We also don't even have to get married if we don't want to. Getting married and starting a family was once seemingly the only reasonable life course. Today, we've become far more accepting of alternative lifestyles, and people move in and out of different situations. Single with roommates, single and solo, single with partner, married, divorced, divorced and living with an iguana, remarried with an iguana, then divorced with 7 iguanas because your iguana obsession ruined your relationship, and finally single with 6 iguanas. Arturo was sadly run over by an ice cream truck. There are no longer any predetermined life paths. Each of us is on our own. When we do marry, we are marrying for love. We are finding our soulmates, and the tools we have to find our soulmates are incredible. We aren't limited to just the bing-bongs who live in our building. We have online dating that gives us access to millions and millions of bing-bongs around the world. We can filter them any way we want. When we go out, we can use smartphones to text any number of suitors while we are out bar-hopping. We aren't constrained by landlines and relegated to whomever we have made firm plans with. Our romantic options are unprecedented, and our tools to sort and communicate with them are staggering. And that raises the question, why are so many people frustrated? For the book, Eric and I wanted to see what would happen if we were able to gather groups from different generations to discuss dating past and present. We organized a large focus group of 200 people. We sent out an invite and said that anyone who attended had to bring one or two parents to the event. Then, when people showed up, we split the families into two different sections. Young folks on the left and parents on the right. We spent an hour going back and forth between the sides, asking people to explain how they met new people to date, asked each other out, and made decisions about marriage and commitment. When we talked to the older people who were in happy, successful marriages, the way they had met sounded quaint and simple, with much less stress than singles go through today. Sure, they met at a young age and probably weren't as sophisticated then as they later became, but as one woman told me, we grew up and changed together, and here we are in our 60s still together. People from the older generation there that night had almost always asked each other out immediately over the phone or in person. This is how a gentleman named Tim described the first time he asked out his future wife. I saw her at school, and I said, you know, I have these tickets to see The Who at Madison Square Garden. That sounds infinitely cooler than texting back and forth with the girl for 2 weeks only to have her flake on seeing a Sugar Ray concert. When I talked to the people about dating back in the day, they said they'd go to one bar or a mixer, which was like a community dance, usually put on by a church or college or other local institution, where young people could talk and meet. They'd stay there the whole night and have one or two drinks. That seems more pleasant than what I see out in bars today, which is usually a bunch of people staring at their phones trying to find someone or something more exciting than where they are. What about all our options? We can find the perfect person now, right? The old folks actually saw it as a disadvantage. They expressed sympathy and concern about their children's situation and gratitude that things had been simpler, albeit far from perfect, when they were young. Something I have to say in defense of the young folks today is that there's just so many choices out there, one mom said. When I was growing up, there was a mixer, and there was a bar, and that was about it. But now, my God, I would really hate to be single nowadays. Why do you think it's so bad for them? I asked. Think about all the options young people have now, all the doors that are there for them to open. The older folks weren't buying it. They understood that they had had fewer options when they were growing up, but intriguingly, they didn't seem to regret having fewer choices. As one woman explained, you didn't think about the choices you had. When you found someone you liked, you jumped into a relationship. I don't think we thought, well, there are another 12 doors or another 17 doors or another 433 doors, she said. We saw a door we wanted, and so we took it. Now, look at my generation. We're in a hallway with millions of doors. That's a lot of doors. It's nice to have all those options. But a hallway with millions of doors? Is that better? Is it terrifying? On the one hand, you have so many doors to try, and that sounds better than being shoved into a door when you are really young and maybe not quite ready to be an adult. On the other hand, maybe people in those earlier generations were ready to open a door on their own. After all, think of Amelia, Victoria, and all those other women who were dying to get out of their parents' houses for good and pretty happy to race into the first door they saw. Sometimes the marriages they raced into wound up being lonely and difficult, but often they blossomed into something loving and fulfilling. Today, we want a bunch of doors as options, and we are very cautious about which one we open. The emerging adulthood phase of life is basically a pass society gives you to hang out in the hallway and figure out what door is really right for you. Being in that hallway might be frustrating at times, but ideally you grow and mature and you find a door that really works for you when you're ready. People who are looking for love today have an unprecedented set of options in the search for an amazing romantic partner or ideally soulmate. We can marry pretty much whomever we want to, regardless of their sex, gender, ethnicity, religion, or race, or even location. We're more likely than the generations that came before us to have relationships in which both partners are equals. And unlike many in prior generations, nearly all of us will only marry someone we love. The thing is, with all these new possibilities, the process of finding that person can be seriously stressful. And unlike the days when most everyone got married by their mid-20s, today the search for love can go on for decades. No more marrying the upstairs neighbor or the girl next door. No more going steady forever with your high school sweetheart. No more, hey mom and dad, that person in the living room seems nice, cool if we get married in 3 months. Instead, we have a whole new romantic culture based on an epic search for the right person. A search that can take us through college and various career stages. A search that also takes new forms, because in today's romantic climate, a lot of the action happens on our screens. Phone world. In 2014, the average American spent 444 minutes per day, nearly 7.5 hours, in front of a screen, be it a smartphone, tablet, television, or personal computer. That's higher than the numbers in most European countries where people spend only 5 to 7 hours per day with screens, yet it's not nearly enough to put the United States in the top 5 nations. China, Brazil, Vietnam, the Philippines, and in first place, Indonesia, where people spend 9 hours per day staring at a screen. That 7.5 hours number is really high, but I charted my own use, and it doesn't seem too implausible. Today is a fairly normal Sunday morning in Los Angeles for me. I woke up and spent a while texting with my friends Nick and Chelsea about a potential brunch destination. I then hopped on my laptop to research the suggested restaurants. I went on Yelp and the restaurant pages to peep the menus and did random browsing in between, reading whatever silly headlines caught my eye on Reddit and watching the highlights from the previous night's Saturday Night Live. The Reddit highlight being a video of a group of kids who turned their door into a door monster that gave out Halloween candy. The door was old-timey and had two smaller shutters in the upper left and right that opened, and they put eyes in them, and then put a brown felt-covered arm that poked through another opening, so it was a door monster giving out candy. It was pretty cute. Then, eventually, after about 20 back-and-forths that lasted an hour and 7 minutes, Chelsea and Nick decided they just wanted to go to a casual diner nearby. I didn't feel like going there. We didn't even end up getting brunch together. Instead, I went to another place, Kenley, with another brunch crew. During that brunch, a Nelly song came on, and I researched the Nelly Wikipedia page, as one must do any time Nelly-related questions plague one's mind. After brunch, on the way home, I texted with a few other people about potential dinner plans. This experiment has made it very clear that the majority of my day is spent on my phone or laptop trying to figure out both where and with whom I am dining. And now, I'm reading my book on an iPad for an audio recording, so you lazy piece of shit, could listen to me instead of reading the book yourself. But the way I spent the day trying to plan brunch is remarkably similar to how my tenure in the single world went as well. Making or attempting to make plans on my phone with whoever was in my dating orbit at the time. Like my brunch with Chelsea and Nick, many times these plans would eventually fall through. And in the same way I cautiously research these restaurants, young singles are researching one another on dating sites or social media sites or even just doing general Googling to get a better sense of a potential date. As I've come to see it, we're spending so much time with our digital devices because we've all developed our own personal phone worlds. Through our phone world, we are connected to anyone and everyone in our lives, from our parents to a casual acquaintance whom we friend on Facebook. For younger generations, their social lives play out through social media sites like Instagram, Twitter, Tinder, and Facebook as much as through campuses, cafes, and clubs. But in recent years, as more and more adults have begun spending more and more time on their digital devices, just about everybody with the means to buy a device and a data plan has become a hyper-engaged participant in their phone world. Phone world is the place you go when you want to find someone to see a movie with. It's where you go to decide what movie to go see. It's where you buy the tickets. It's where you let your friend know you have arrived at the theater. It's where your friend tells you, shit, I'm at the wrong theater. And where you say, what the fuck, man? You always do this. Fine, I'm off to go see G.I. Joe Retaliation alone. Again. And now that our phone worlds are integral to even the most mundane of tasks, of course, they are also a big part of where we live our romantic lives. Today, if you own a smartphone, you're carrying a 24/7 singles bar in your pocket. Press a few buttons at any time of the day, and you're instantly immersed in an ocean of romantic possibilities. At first, swimming through that ocean may seem amazing. But most modern singles quickly realize that it takes a ton of effort to stay afloat, and even more to find the right person and get to shore together. There's so much going on in those waters. So many quick decisions and difficult moves to make. And of all the challenges, there's none more daunting than figuring out what to do when you find someone who interests you. As we saw in my example with Tanya, no matter how simple it may seem, the initial ask can be plagued with stress and frightening ramifications. Chapter 2, The Initial Ask. Asking someone out on a date is a simple task that frequently becomes a terrifying conundrum of fear, self-doubt, and anxiety. It's full of tough decisions. How do I ask? In person? Phone call? Text? What do I say? Could this person be the person I end up spending the rest of my life with? What if this is the only person for me? What if I fuck it all up with the wrong message? Though technology has added a few new, modern quirks to this dilemma, asking a new person to go on a romantic outing has never been easy. It means declaring your attraction to someone and putting yourself out there in a huge way, while risking the brutal possibility of rejection, or in the modern era, even an unexplained icy cold silence. For the modern dater, the first decision is picking the medium to use, call or text. Some people even throw email or social media messaging into the mix. Just a generation ago, the landline or even a newspaper classified ad would have been a first stop to finding romance. Today, though, we look at our screens almost immediately. In fact, for many daters, a large chunk of their romantic world lives in their phone world. A quick note. The numbers show that men are still overwhelmingly the ones expected to initiate the first ask. In 2012, only 12% of American women had asked anyone out in the previous year. So, when discussing this, I use the situation of a guy asking a girl out. The issues discussed generally translate both ways, minus the issue of girls hating dudes initiating with penis photos. Alright, let's see what the overall trends are. In 2013, the Match.com survey researchers asked Americans, if you were asking someone out on a first date, which method of communication would you be most likely to use to get in contact? Here's what they found. For those over 30, 52% would use a phone call, 28% face-to-face, 8% text message, email, 7%. For those under 30, 23% said a phone call, 37% said face-to-face, 32% said text message, email, 1%. Two things to note here. First, the drop in phone calls as a preferred method as age groups get younger is stark. It goes from 52% to 23%. Among teenagers, the percentage who use text messaging is even higher. In a 2012 Text Plus survey, 58% of Americans between ages 13 and 17 said they'd ask someone out with a text message. It's clear that younger people, who are growing up in a more text-heavy culture, are much more comfortable living their romantic lives via text. Second, over time, so are all of us. In 2010, only 10% of young adults used text to ask someone out for the first time, compared with 32% in 2013. Asking out someone via text is on course to be the new norm. The phone call is quickly being phased out. It's worth pausing here to note that this is an insanely fast transformation in how we communicate. For many generations, young people used telephone calls to reach out to possible romantic partners. It was a harrowing experience that we could all relate to. Before the initial ask, you would hear terrifying rings, and then an answer. It could be the object of your desire, or a roommate, or even a parent. At that point, you would ask to speak with the person you wanted to ask out. If they were around, the person would finally say, "Hello," and a mild panic would ensue. You would have to spend some time chatting them up, trying to form a bond, while also setting things up for a possibly awkward segue into a date ask. Hey, so, lost the pie-eating contest, and, you want to see a movie sometime? This phone call ask required some bravery to initiate, and some skills to execute properly, but over time, you'd get better at it, and you would strategize these calls. Let's say you were a young man named Darren. At first, your calls might be something like this. Hey, Stephanie, it's me, Darren. Hey, Darren, how are you? I'm good. Okay, bye. But soon, you'd get better. With time, you'd realize how to be confident on these kind of calls. You'd have a funny anecdote or a conversation piece ready. Witty banter would be at the tip of your tongue. And soon, you and Stephanie would be two verbal fencers, parrying and reposting it up like this. Hey, Stephanie, it's me, Darren! Hey, Darren, this is Stephanie's mom. One second. Shit. You got this, Darren. You got this. Hello? Hey, Stephanie, it's me, Darren! Oh, hey, Darren, what's up? I just got an umbrella! Cool. All right, bye! Well, you'd get better than that. The skill that went into making a phone call to a romantic interest is one that younger generations may never need or want to build. As our technology becomes more prevalent in our lives, romantic behavior that seems strange or inappropriate to one generation can become the norm for people in the next one. For instance, in a recent survey, 67% of teens said they'd accept an invitation to prom by text. For older generations, the idea of getting invited to something as special as prom by a text message may sound cold and impersonal. It seems inappropriate for the occasion. But younger folks live in a text-heavy environment, and this shapes their perception of what is appropriate. For example, in a topic we'll revisit in more depth later, breaking up with someone via text seems pretty brutal to people of my generation, but when we interviewed younger people, several said their breakups happened exclusively by text. For younger generations, who knows what texts lie ahead? Fire emoji, house emoji, parentheses, your house burned down. I'm pregnant, dot dot dot. It's not yours. The dad is this dude I met in Miami a few weeks ago. Really sorry. Let's discuss when you get home. Hey, it's Dr. Sampson. Bad news. You got cancer in your testicles. Frowny face. The rise of the text message. Texting, otherwise known as short message service, SMS, was thought up by Friedhelm Hillebrand, a German engineer, in 1984 and achieved for the first time by Neil Papworth, a young British engineer who messaged his friend, Merry Christmas, in 1992. Alas, his friend didn't reply because his mobile phone didn't allow him to input text. Sure it didn't. That's the same shit I hear from friends who don't respond to my mass Merry Christmas text. I even throw in a custom image every year. Man, audiobook people, you don't get to see that image. Well, it was in there, but you can look on, I don't know, just Google Aziz Christmas card. Maybe an image will come up. That said, can you imagine how insane it must have been to get the first text of all time? When no one knew what a text was, it would have been like, why are there words on my phone? Phones are for numbers! In 1997, Nokia introduced a mobile phone with a separate keyboard, setting things up for the BlackBerry epidemic that would soon afflict most of the global yuppie community. But it wasn't until 1999 that text messages could cross from one phone network to another. And after that, usage began to rise. In 2007, the number of texts exchanged in a month outnumbered the number of phone calls made in the United States for the first time in history. And in 2010, people sent 6.1 trillion texts across the planet, roughly 200,000 per minute. Technology companies have introduced all kinds of new services to help us exchange short messages, and we've responded by tapping away like never before. And of course, this has translated to a vast increase in the number of romantic interactions that are being carried out over text. One reason for the spike in asking people out by text is that far more of us have smartphones with big screens that make messaging fun and easy. According to consumer surveys, the portion of all American adults who owned a smartphone went from 17% in 2010 to 58% in 2014. And they're most prevalent among those emerging adults between ages 18 and 29, 83% of whom carry a smartphone wherever they go. When we're not doing traditional texting, we now have apps like WhatsApp, Facebook Messenger, iMessage, and direct messaging on Twitter, which allows us to message for free. Throughout the world, a growing number of people are using SMS for basic communications, and young people in particular have adopted texting at the expense of old-fashioned phone calls. That said, we haven't given up our old habits altogether. Many people, including